Thank you for inviting me to join your worship service today. I hope to connect some dots this morning, drawing a line between where we've been, where we are, and where we go from here. It's important to step back and take in this wider perspective from time to time. Otherwise, we're just lost in the woods and we risk engaging in the illusion of making progress. I'd like to begin today by offering a prayer to the people of the First Nations whose land we're on today. We honor you, the people of the First Nations, who lived during the time of first contact and through the suffering that followed. We honor you by learning to see and hear the voices of your descendants and by learning to live in right relations today. Why do I start by honoring the people of the First Nations? It's easy to forget how the Doctrine of Discovery shaped the early development of the U.S. Steve Newcomb, author of 500 Years of Injustice, offers us this insight into the Doctrine of Discovery. When Christopher Columbus first set foot on the white sands of Guanahani Island, he performed a ceremony to take possession of the land for the King and Queen of Spain, acting under the international laws of Western Christendom. Although the story of Columbus's so-called discovery has taken on mythological proportions in most of the Western world, few people are aware that this act of possession was based on a religious doctrine known as the Doctrine of Discovery. And even fewer people realize today that 5 centuries later, the United States government still uses this archaic Judeo-Christian doctrine to deny the rights of Native American Indians. The Doctrine of Discovery was specifically designed for sanctioning and promoting conquest, colonization, and exploitation of non-Christian nations and their territory. From the very beginning, those in power believed themselves to be superior to the people they deemed unworthy. The people, their land, and all of their possessions were there for the taking, and this was justified by a divine right bestowed by God. It's a very important passage to remember from that book. This process of determining who is inside the circle of humanity and who is not set the stage for slavery. Africans were deemed as an exploitable resource, a people who were outside the circle of humanity, with which Westerners in power could do with as they wished. Those who had money and power justified their actions and wrote their version of humankind's narrative to serve their own interests. This narrative was created to justify genocide of native peoples, their forced migration, the destruction of their homes, and their death. The African slave was deemed less than human, and they too suffered and died and were used to increase the fortunes of those who had the wealth and power. The abolitionist movement was powered by those who were morally opposed to slavery. This was a moral movement. The UK had already abolished slavery in 1833, and their movement fueled the abolitionists in the US, giving them hope for ending slavery here as well. The first period of Reconstruction was much more than simply a transitional period out of a slave economy. Reverend Dr. William Barber, author of The Third Reconstruction, wrote, "More blacks were elected to public office during the period of 1868 to 1880 than any other time in American history. During the first fusion movement, blacks and whites joined together to reconstruct the nation in ways that would make it possible to move towards the noble goals of justice and equality. Some of the most progressive economic, educational, and labor laws in our nation's history were passed during this era." White supremacists who rose to power in the 1870s attacked this movement, and terrorist tactics were used to destroy the progress that was made. Jim Crow laws became the order of the day, and it would be 100 years later before we would see the second Reconstruction take hold. By the 1960s, structural racism and oppression had become entrenched. The South had clearly defined segregation practices, but structural racism was also present in the North and throughout the rest of the U.S. as well. The only difference was that the signs, the physical signs indicating white space versus black space were not clearly posted. Where black people were allowed to be and where they were not, however, was clearly understood in the North, in the Midwest, and the western half of the country as it was in the Jim Crow South. From the 1880s through the 1920s, we saw record numbers of immigrants arrive on our shores, as well as the expansion of U.S. imperialism and both deplorable working conditions and the rise of powerful labor movements. As is evident today, corporate interests and the divide between the very wealthy and the very poor were powerful forces both driving and opposing change. Throughout this period of time, those in power continued to define who was within the circle of humanity and who was not. It's important to remember that the corporate titans of the early 20th century effectively bought the McKinley presidency. Powerful corporate interests manipulating the democratic process is not a 21st century invention. The lessons learned from the fusion movement that arose during the first Reconstruction informed the second Reconstruction. The hard-won cases celebrated as a result of the civil rights era in the 1960s were quickly undermined, however, as they were following the first Reconstruction. It was at this time that we saw the rise of the new Jim Crow, so expertly defined by Michelle Alexander in her book titled The New Jim Crow. It's no coincidence that mass incarceration followed the civil rights era. Consider these developments also identified in Reverend Dr. Barber's book. Convict leasing, whereby white plantation owners had cooperated with local law enforcement throughout the South to arrest former slaves for the charge of vagrancy, and then putting them back sometime onto plantations sometimes where they had earlier been enslaved, the very same plantations where they had been enslaved. If convict leasing was a legal means of continuing slavery in the 20th century, then this so-called war on drugs has been a legal means to extend second-class citizenship for African Americans into the 21st century. It's important to remember, I think sometimes we forget, that the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery excludes those who are incarcerated. Lee Atwater, who mastered Deconstruction's new tactics and later became chief Republican strategist, said, "You start out in 1954 by saying, N-word, N-word, N-word. And by 1968, you can't say that word anymore. It hurts you. It backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. You're getting so abstract now that you're talking about cutting taxes, and all these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is that blacks get hurt worse than whites." Reverend Barber goes on to say, "It's no coincidence that Ronald Reagan announced his candidacy in Neshoba County, Mississippi, talking about states' rights on the hallowed ground where civil rights workers Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, and James Earl Cheney spilled their blood in 1964 to challenge a state that would not acknowledge black people's humanity. He wrote that before the election of Donald Trump, and it's sad to think about the parallels and the echoes that still continue in that campaign and this presidency as to what happened during the Reagan era and what he describes. I tell you all this because it's important that we first understand what we're up against. Ending mass incarceration, fighting for immigrant rights, economic and climate justice, and the protection of our political process, these are not mutually exclusive issues that we're tasked to take on. I visited many congregations this past year and several years before, and I've been talking about this very issue. When we see the myriad of social justice issues as being siloed or disconnected from one another, we can easily feel overwhelmed and inadequate. Or we become so focused on what we're doing, we become blind to the bigger picture. Racism and oppression are not issues that we're tasked to take on. They are integral. We have to see racism and systems of oppression to central to everything that we do. We have to hold people who are most vulnerable in the center and understand that racism is the root of all the injustice that manifests in our world today. Ours is a justice movement. It's not an issue movement. An important statement that captures just how the most vulnerable in our communities are being targeted can be found in the film, The House I Live In. In this film, Richard Miller, a historian, shared these words. Raoul Hilberg wrote of the destruction of the European Jews in the Holocaust. We've long known that this process of destruction is an undertaking, step by step. I realized that there was a chain of destruction. What he was talking about could be expressed as links in a chain. Around the world, in more than one society, people do the same thing again and again, decade after decade, century after century. Now, this chain of destruction begins with a phase we can call identification, in which a group of people is identified as the cause of problems in society. Sound familiar? People start to perceive their fellow citizens as bad. They're evil. They used to be worthwhile people, but now all of a sudden, for some reason, their lives are worthless. The second link in the chain of destruction is ostracism, by which we learn to hate these people. How to take their jobs away. How to make it harder for them to survive. People lose their place to live. Often they're forced into ghettos where they're physically isolated, separated from the rest of society. And the third link is confiscation. People lose their rights, their civil liberties. The laws themselves change, so it's made easier for people to be stuck on the street, patted down and searched, and their property to be confiscated. Now, once you start taking people's property away, you can start taking the people themselves away. And the fourth link is concentration. Concentrate them into facilities such as prisons, camps. People lose their rights. They can't vote anymore, have children anymore. Often their labor is exploited in a very systematic form. And the final link of the chain of destruction is annihilation. Now, this may be indirect, say by withholding medical care, withholding food, preventing further birth, or it might be direct where death is inflicted, where people are deliberately killed. These steps tend to happen at their own momentum without anybody forcing them to happen. I think a lot of people would be disturbed and outraged by the thought that any part of this process could be going on in America. But it wasn't until I started studying the drug war that I realized that some of these same steps were happening today. Now, he wrote that in response to his reflections on the drug war, but we certainly could see the patterns in immigration and many other areas today. I'd like to emphasize that despite the powerful forces we're up against, change is possible. We can dismantle systems of oppression if we work together. And in fact, we are starting to see some systems slowly, but they're starting to unravel, like mass incarceration in our state. How does change occur? I'm sure everyone here has made changes in their lives. In my work as a clinical social worker, which is my other job, I help people to make changes in their lives every day. There's a model of change that identifies the first step as precognition. This is the stage before a person even recognizes that a problem exists. This is true for an individual, but it's also true when considering social problems. In the words of James Baldwin, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." The next stage is contemplation. It's here when we begin to recognize and understand that a problem exists. And during this stage, a person typically does research, talks to others, and learns more about what's troubling them. This is an important part of the process because you must have a clear understanding of what is happening, not just what you think is happening. Building relationships with those who are directly affected is crucial during this phase. It's easy to be swayed by the narrative created by those who oppose change, who want us to believe that the poor are poor because they're lazy. Incarcerated people are all criminals, or otherwise they wouldn't be in jail. And immigrants just have to come to this country the right way, and our planet's climate is perfectly fine. Understanding the reality of people's lives by hearing their stories prepares a person for the next stage of change, which is preparation and taking action. As with individuals of movements, this stage of change works best when you're not alone. Knowing who will support you as you work towards significant change is very important. Often, the hardest part of making change is rewriting your own personal narrative and identifying what's possible. When confronting daunting social change, my well of strength is centered on my personal experiences. Growing up, I was subjected to significant abuse in my home, and the first time I embraced major change is when I became aware that I did not have to endure that pain anymore, and I left. I didn't know what was going to happen next. I just knew that things could no longer stay the same, and I took action. The next 2 years were very difficult, but it was a valuable learning experience for me to see how hard life is for so many people, which is often invisible to those who don't know struggle. After 2 years, I was tired of surviving. I knew I couldn't continue to live as I had been, but I didn't know what to do about it. I eventually found support and a way out, but the biggest challenge was changing how I saw myself and the world around me. I had to be willing to take chances and look for solutions instead of identifying obstacles. By taking that first step, even if I was unsure of the outcome, time and time again, I changed my future. I earned my GED despite feeling that it would be impossible to learn again. I graduated from college despite knowing how hard it would be to pay for it. I met my partner and started a family despite my fears that I would not know how to create a healthy family. These experiences are the foundation for every risk I've taken since those early days. We need more people to ask why not when undertaking major challenges. Too often we're lulled into the belief that only incremental change is possible because change takes time, or it's not even worth trying because that's just the way the world is. When I get discouraged, I think back to the abolitionist movement in the UK. All of our tactics for creating change can be traced back to this movement. From the sugar boycott they led to petition drives, speaking and book tours by former slaves, the use of graphic illustrations to show how the slaves were being treated, and lobbying Parliament, today's activists owe an enormous debt of gratitude to these early trailblazers. This group of men made the decision to end slavery, not improve conditions for slaves, not regulate the slave trade, but to abolish it altogether because that was the morally right thing to do. At the time, 3/4 of the world's economy was based in the slave trade. Yet they were undaunted, and by the power they were up against, and they forged ahead anyway. What could we learn from them as we contemplate what's possible today? We, those who believe that justice is a moral calling, need to remember the words of Frederick Douglass, who taught us that power concedes nothing without demand. Reverend Dr. Barber elaborated on this when he said, "Because power blinds broken human beings to injustice, the most powerful among us will always ignore and laugh at the cries of those who suffer." I've been thinking a lot about political and social forces these days. In my role as executive director at UUMass Action, I get to visit congregations from the Berkshires to Boston and from the northern border towns to the Cape and the Islands. I see the struggles in each area of our state, which often differ from the narratives told by some of our political leaders. I've also concluded that the way we were organizing in the past needed to change and was no longer effective. And I see this continuing pattern in many of our congregations, and we need to change how we do things as well. Getting involved in issues, seeing things as separated and numbers of issues and who's trying to lead which issue and get attention from the congregation, this just saps our energy and turns us against each other. We argue about whose issue is more important, and we feel overwhelmed by a seemingly endless array of social problems that urgently need to be addressed. We can do things differently. These are not separate issues. Climate justice, any mass incarceration, immigrant rights, our democratic process, economic justice, I could go on. These all intersect, which is why I begin with the doctrine of discovery and this point of view of who's inside the circle of humanity and who is not. We have to put our vision here higher, and all those issues that we're working on lead towards the change that we wish to see. We can no longer be silent as desperate immigrants flee war and crushing poverty and cry out for help, which is only going to increase because of climate disruption. We can no longer accept the solutionness to joblessness, homelessness, and addiction is to lock people up. We can no longer tolerate a world where people work 2 and 3 jobs and still can't meet their economic needs. We cannot wring our hands in despair and refuse to take responsibility for our behavior as climate change continues to take homes, livelihoods, and the very lives of our human family. We need to understand this period of time as the third Reconstruction. This is a time for us to organize and join the movement calling for a revolution of values, the vision that Reverend Dr. Barber has put forth. We need to identify teams of volunteers who are willing to work together in our congregations, between our congregations, and with our community partners. If we're not thinking about change in a large-scale social movement, then we're really just wasting our precious time. I ask you today to join me. Join me in redefining our concept of we and embracing our vision of that interdependent web of existence, to join together to fight systems of oppression that build walls between us and instead to build bridges. Together, let us know intimately the strands of that web that binds us together and declare through our actions that no one is outside the circle of humanity. What we want is not impossible. Dr. Cornel West said, "We become not optimists who deny reality, but prisoners of hope who work to change reality." It's an honor to be a prisoner of hope with all of you. Please join me and let's get to work. Blessed be.